The Chris Perillo Show is brought to you by Microsoft Windows Media. Download Windows Media Player 10 at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.
Everybody seems to be talking about this MyWeb 2.0 thing, but I don't know how to define it other than saying it was a great way of putting a label on something that you could charge $2,800 for. Of course, the MyWeb 2.0 conference by O'Reilly, and not to say that it was a bad conference by any stretch of the imagination, just a little out of my price range, out of something that, you know, I think I would want to pay for a conference. That's the only way I can define my Web 2.0, as opposed to MyWeb 2.0, which is the social bookmarking service by Yahoo, but I don't know. I still don't think MyWeb 2.0 is something that you can define or is defined. It's just something that someone in marketing decided to slap on this new revolution, so to speak, this evolution, as it were. We had been laying low for several months, several years, you know, after the dot-com bust, and still doing things. You know, that's how blogging kind of took hold, or when blogging took hold, I should say. And a few of us have been around for at least that long, and now it seems the market's ready to rebound. People are willing to make investments in not just technologies, but specifically people and audiences of people. And I think you see this reflected in recent acquisitions like AOL buying Engadget. I mean, Weblogs Inc. Might as well have been they bought Engadget, or eBay acquiring Skype. And one of the blogs that's out there that is following this, and I think has become pretty much, well, in my opinion, the Engadget of Web 2.0, TechCrunch, and Mike Arrington is here with me, well, virtually at least, on Vonage. And you sound okay, Mike.
Yeah, it sounds like it's working pretty well.
Do I sound okay to you then?
You sound crystal clear, Chris.
So now let's see if we can do this. Is Vonage a Web 2.0 company?
Well, it lets people read and write verbally, so I guess in some sense it is. I certainly think Skype is, and Vonage isn't too far away. So
you think Skype's a Web 2.0 company? Why?
First of all, I think my favorite definition of Web 2.0 is John Furrier's. He has a podcasting service called PodTech. Dave Weiner linked to this as well. And somebody asked him what he thought about Web 2.0, or I think he actually left a comment on a blog. He said it's basically Web 1.0, but it's the next version. And I think, to me, that kind of says it all, and I think you probably feel the same way.
Yeah, it's
With regard to, you know, whether or not Skype is Web 2.0, I haven't been thinking about this nearly as long as you and others have. My first deep thinking on Web 2.0 came from a blog post by Fred Wilson called Blogging. I think it's titled Blogging 1.0, and I think it came out in February of this year. And he talked about sort of GeoCities and how that was 1.0 and how blogging is now 2.0, and he's followed up on that post a number of times, and you know, at this point he defines Flickr as blogging, and I think a lot of us do. But you know, to me, you know, the web facilitates interactions between people, and in particular, two-way interactions seem to be the way to go today. So any kind of application that facilitates the two-way communication between people, as opposed to the television experience of just looking at content and hearing what one person has to say, I think is Web 2.0 loosely defined.
And that's pretty much what inspired you to evolve TechCrunch from where it was to where it is?
Yeah, I think I got pretty excited about some of the applications that came out. Most of them, a lot of them came out last year or became very well known last year, and I got pretty excited about them, started following them, seeing how either they were evolving or sort of the next version of those services evolved, and just got very excited tracking those companies and seeing what new features came out and how that affected the whole ecosystem. And that, frankly, that's why I started writing TechCrunch in June, was just to sort of publish my own notes on what I was seeing and what I was thinking about those companies.
Wait a second. You said ecosystem. Have you ever worked for Microsoft?
No. I'm actually quoting I just wrote a post today, and I talked about a few VCs, and in interviewing some of the VCs, they talk about the web ecosystem, and I do see it as an ecosystem, though, of the entire web.
You know what? Every time I think of the word ecosystem, I get a mental picture of, like, entropy and, like, badgers and, you know, moss. It's not pretty when I think ecosystem. It's definitely not technology. It's definitely not a sphere of anything geeky. Something that's natural.
I see it as the interconnectedness. I don't know if that's a word, but interconnectedness of companies and how they interact. And also, you know, I really do think of web companies today as species in an ecosystem. And those species are evolving, and some are going extinct, and some are turning into different species, different companies. And so, you know, a bit of it is, you know, the fittest survive, and a bit of it is we all rely on each other for, you know, to stay healthy.
Oh, certainly. Now, your background is not necessarily in technology specifically, and you've basically...
No, I actually was originally an attorney at Wilson Sonsini.
Can't believe that.
In the late 90s, and left there in early 2000 to become an entrepreneur. Did that for a few years, so... And just recently started doing, you know, additional projects in the space, so...
And you've kind of come out and pseudo-announced it, or at least announced that you're working on something.
Yep. My partner and I, Keith Tier, started Archimedes Ventures earlier this year. And actually, I think the goal of Archimedes Ventures is to launch companies, and we're working on a few. And again, that thinking through those companies became part of the process of making that we were doing our due diligence on other companies, and you know, that led to writing about them.
So you were starting a company, or you had the company, and then out of that sprang TechCrunch?
Yeah, and it's a little bit of a two-way process, but in thinking about our own companies, that company is called Edgio, and we haven't launched it yet. I've written a little bit about it on TechCrunch, but in thinking about that company and thinking about the features it's going to have, we started talking to our advisors, one of which is Dave Weiner. And Dave gave me the best piece of advice I've gotten at least all year. And that was, if you're going to build companies, make sure that you do the due diligence and you see what other people are creating and inventing, and leverage that instead of reinventing the wheel. And I certainly took that to heart. So, you know, being an attorney and being disciplined and due diligence and things like that, I started looking into every single company in the space. And starting with a bit of a clean slate, because I did just recently start looking at these newer companies, I started with Technorati, and I started with Flickr, and I started with, you know, all the basic sort of known Web 2.0 companies and branched out from there. And after a couple of weeks of just doing the due diligence, I realized I might as well start writing about it, and so TechCrunch was born.
Well, let me say thank you for keeping all the vowels in your domain, because if I see another if I see another freaking application, web, whatever, application, website, that goes after the dropping the E before the R, as in like a Flickr-style name, I'm going to shoot someone. It's been done, and if I see it being done again, what do people think when they do that? Do they think that makes them more valid than they are without having a name like that?
First, did dropping the vowels come first, or delicious come first?
God, don't even get me going about delicious. I mean, you try to tell someone, no, go to delicious. Is that delicious.com? No, it's D-E, or is it D-E-L? No, D-E-D, D-dot, no, D. This is what the conversation, so you have to, like.
I think the I comes after the first
my God.
Dot,
it,
but I'm
no,
100%
it,
sure.
It's D-E-L dot I-C-I-O dot U-S. I've learned how to spell delicious with the dots, but trying to explain this to someone who doesn't get it, no wonder this stuff isn't taking off.
I did notice you launched a company using a non.com domain name recently.
I had to. And the Belgians love me, by the way. They just say, oh, this is great. He's using .be. Well, I mean, it was central not only in separating ourselves from the pack. And, of course, we registered like gadda.be, gadabe.com.
Sure.
You know, went through all the derivations of that. But, or I guess alternatives. But ultimately, you know, it was trying to save keystrokes any which way, and I mean, not
sure.
Just on the keyboard, but you know, on a thumb pad or a T9 type of a text entering system. But yeah, we certainly went out on a limb, and I think someone at 9, what's the website? They're big into design. Nine rules. Yeah, nine rules. Started a thread saying, what is this with alternative domain, these TLDs? First it was delicious, now it's gotta be. And the thread was actually very interesting. It was very telling. A lot of people kind of joking, like, I still don't know how to spell delicious. In terms of the social bookmarking service, and sometimes having to reinvent the rules. And some people have speculated, well, it's interesting to make the URL actually part of the service, not just a gateway to the service. And certainly I'm happy to have kind of been, if that's a trend, certainly happy to have been part of it. I think it's kind of neat to be able to use the URL. It just adds for people who don't get it, they don't need to get it. And for the people who get it, they say, wow, that's really geeky cool. It's like, I never even thought about doing that before.
What country is .de?
Belgian.
Okay. Belgian. So I'm sure they have a reasonably active domain space, so you're not actually disrupting traffic there.
No, not really. The people who have made comments, when I've translated from Dutch, there is no Belgianese, by the way. When I went look, Babelfish, where the hell's Belgianese? I knew it was Dutch. Some people had made comments saying, wow, cool, now we've got a legitimate domain because this is happening in our space. And out of all the traffic, in what we've been able to record, and it's unfortunately not been perfect because the way we're serving up traffic right now, it goes U.S., Canada, and then like right around the U.K., and then, well, actually, Canada and Germany seem to swap places. So
yeah.
Canada and Germany are pretty active, and, of course, Belgium's up in there as well. Not exactly in the, I don't think... Probably they're in the top 10, but they're nowhere near the top. So even with a .be domain, we haven't gotten to that point. Now, when we start allowing domains or subdomains to include Unicode characters, it's certainly going to increase our reach, because a URL with a Unicode character is just as valid as a URL without a Unicode character. And a Unicode character would allow for using extended characters with like umlauts and tildes and all that stuff. So it's that's certainly been interesting. But and thank you, by the way, for your review of that.
I got to tell you, it was actually one of my most popular posts. When I'm using something called MeasureMap, which is a really cool new adaptive path service to track analytics in the blog, and I'm pretty sure Gata is still one of my top 10 posts out of 300 or 400 total posts in the last couple of months. So it got a lot of attention, and I know it. You guys got so much traffic, and certainly not mostly from me, but it caused a few problems on your launch date. But it's a good problem to have.
Yeah, we learned a few lessons, but it wasn't a bad thing, because even the people who couldn't get in, they wanted to figure out why they wanted to get in, and having that kind of desire, I guess, was a pretty good thing.
It became an exclusive thing.
Yeah, whether it wanted to be or not. In fact, the idea was kind of just the opposite, making it open. I think it's interesting in seeing, I think a lot more companies now, what has me excited about what's happening at this point, whether you want to put a term on it or not, is the openness and the interactivity, and to be able to go in and do something like I Gotta Be, where I'm not going to get screamed at by Flickr for doing what I'm doing. If anything, I would be assisted by Flickr for doing what I'm doing.
Open data both in and out, I think, is where the interesting stuff is happening today. And that's actually why I was a little bit disappointed in a Craigslist request for Oodle to take their data out of Oodle.
They don't get it.
I think it's bad for, it's worse for Craigslist in the long run than it is for Oodle. I think that's too bad.
I have a different perspective on that. I know Craig Newmark, good guy, solid guy. Mm-hmm. And I had basically emailed him. I said, look, I'm doing this Gotta Be service, and I want on our shopping page, I want to include like an aggregate feed from Craigslist. I said, would you be able to do this, like an aggregate feed, not just I couldn't necessarily say we only got the LA feed because that only helps these people, and I want an aggregate feed because some of the stuff is just as valid locally as well.
Was his concern with the traffic? He didn't want the server hits?
I just don't think he understood what I was doing, and quite honestly, I don't think a lot of people understand what it is I'm doing. And to tell you the truth, I don't even know if I understand what it is.
I wrote about
doing
it. I don't get it. I just know it's awesome. So.
Yeah, it's like, well, you don't need, there's enough that we're playing with it. We've got it. There's certainly a business model behind what it is we're doing, but you've got to be, in my opinion, and maybe you're the same, mind, in creating goals, sometimes it can be tricky because two weeks from now, something else could launch and completely change the landscape. Completely.
Yeah.
And render a business plan null and void. So you have to be, you know, nimble enough to see, number one, when you launch, are you really differentiated? As, you know, in the immortal words of Dave Weiner, as he said, you know, watch this stuff. It's being able to pivot easily around what's happening around you. And that, I think, is almost another key part that plays very well into the open nature of what we have now. And I think those are fundamentally, it's a basic building block of what made blogging blogging. And another reason why a lot of mainstream press just doesn't get it yet. And the decentralized idea of sharing information, getting information, doing things, and not feeling like you're locked into something. Which, and I don't know if you've got an opinion on this, and I'm not sure if I caught it on TechCrunch, if it was really TechCrunch news, but I think it was just absolutely gigantic, monumental, when Microsoft and Yahoo decided to say, all right, we're working together.
Oh, it's terrific.
That
yeah, and even if the motivation was fear, you know, rather than goodwill, it's an absolutely terrific step forward.
Now, do you think it's going to be something that AOL is going to start playing along with soon, or Skype, or you think they're still going to go, no, I think we're going to stay with our own brand?
Well, I mean...
To speculate. Now, obviously, this is just if you want to speculate.
I certainly think my opinion is probably no more valid than anyone else's on this because I have no information. But AOL is clearly on the block to be sold, so I doubt they'll do anything major, you know, around their IM services in the near future. You know, Skype being part of eBay, it's sort of the same thing. I think they're probably in lockdown on anything, you know, interoperability. You know, it sure would be nice. Oh, it sure would be nice if everyone worked with everyone and you could choose your application, your client, and just talk to anyone that you wanted to.
Well, I think Google's going to raise the bar a bit, having recently hired the game developer who, you know, I've never used game. I tried to, but it was unusable. I mean, for a geek, it was unusable, in my opinion. I mean, the user interface was absolutely inexcusable. I mean, it was just bad. it was downright evil. And now Google has got the game guy, and it'll be interesting to see how they start walking down that path. Because I think if anybody's going to really shake it up, it's not going to be the Trillions of the world. It's not going to be the Games of the world. It's going to be Google.
So, if I could take a bit of a left turn, there's something actually I wouldn't mind chatting about.
No, I mean, this is a conversation. I mean, it's not. This isn't really an interview, really. I mean, you can call it an interview if you want.
So I was at your conference in June, and I think anyone who was there will say, you know, without any kind of exaggeration, that it was a bit magical. I mean, you know, just some of the reconciliations that happened there between old foes and just the great group feelings that happened. It was something that was pretty awesome. And it was only a couple of weeks after I started TechCrunch and really got into this stuff. So for me, it was just awesome. And that was followed up for me by Barcamp here in Silicon Valley, which, as everyone knows, was an alternative to the invite-only foo camp that O'Reilly puts on. It was very similar in that you had a lot of people who are extremely passionate about what they do get together, and you had a couple of VCs, but mostly people who work at companies at all levels. You had CEOs there, and you had the rank and file engineers there, and everybody was on equal footing and able to sort of share their ideas. And it's a trend that I'm seeing this year, and I haven't seen it before your conference, although maybe I was just missing it. But a trend of just this great camaraderie that's happening, and people trying to work together, and it's sort of symbolic to me because a lot of the best applications are also open and trying to work with other applications, and it's something that I've latched onto with TechCrunch that we've had. I actually think far more exciting than my blog are the events that we've had, where they're literally barbecues in my backyard with my dog running around, and you know, we're trying to find enough beer for everybody, and we're cooking hamburgers on the grill. But we have people show up, and it's, you know, I just put a post up on my site, and we have a wiki, and it's sort of the word spreads, and people are showing up, and it's just these great sort of opportunities where everybody brings their laptops. You have groups of 4, 5, 20 people demoing products, and sharing ideas, and it's just been great. We're having the third one this Friday, And I'm actually getting a little concerned because it looks like about 200 people are going to show up in this house today. It can't handle that many.
Oh, boy.
But I guess we'll just stick them in the backyard. But we've got some companies demoing that have never been seen in public before. We've got some older companies with new features. I tried to get you to fly down for it. And,
so that was a veiled attempt. So you just said, hey, I'm having a barbecue in the hopes that I would, like, be... See, okay, you got to understand something. You can even ask Ponzi this. I cannot... You have to tell me, like, even if you say dinner's ready, unless you put it in front of me, like, directly in my line of sight, unless you turn my chair around and say, look, I'm not going to get it. I'm not going to get it. Seriously, I'm not going to get it. So, you know, you and I would never be if the world
was
this way.
Chris, I have a point. Wait, my point is, and I apologize for leading you into that as effectively as I did, but my point is just it's a really cool thing, and it's clearly, like, moments like this don't last, and it may not even, you know, maybe even the period of cooperation may be, you know, fading. I don't know, and I hope it isn't, but it sure is a wonderful thing when you're right in the middle of it, and I honestly think years from now we'll look back at this year in particular and see it as probably the best year of the web so far. So I'm just really glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, I think that's one of the most exciting things for me, having been an evangelist for so many things, but, you know, ultimately being there, being one of the first users of movable type, moving over from gray matter, moving over from Blogger, you know, a Blogger Pro user when, you know, Ed was still, you know, ahead of Pyra. In fact, when I first moved to San Francisco, when I took the job for Tech TV, Pyra Labs was down the street, down in Soma, and he was having kind of a going out of business sale or like moving sale, and I bought like a power strip or something from Ev, you know. It's like I should have had him sign it, you know. Having been there when that stuff was happening and seeing everything that's happening today is because of what was happening years ago. So the idea of blogging was very open in the sense that it's okay to link outside your own little space, your own sphere. In fact, LockerGnome itself, which has been around since 1996, for better or for worse, has evolved from where it was in the beginning in 1996, and it almost had to. There are certain other newsletters out there, which is what LockerGnome started as, that have pretty much stayed the same. They've stayed true to the roots, and certainly their audience is appreciated. But LockerGnome has taken a different route in the sense that we've evolved with it. You know, as soon as I saw RSS as kind of like the next big thing, whether it was going to be or not, I totally got behind it. I'm like, no, dude, you got to understand this. So proselytizing that, a few years ago, and jumping on that bandwagon before there was a bandwagon, was part of the building blocks, the openness, the sharing, the understanding about this data interchange and how people are thinking, how people want to work, how people want to be.
It's a beautiful thing.
We're starting to see that, you know, kind of come to fruition. And I think that, if anything, was not necessarily the beginning of Web 2.0 as much as it was just a fundamental change in the way we wanted to be, the way we wanted to live. And blogging was just an outlet for that. And then upon that, now you've got, you know, a tremendous amount of goodwill, communication. And I think this is why people are cautious. Frank Painter, I believe, had posted something today about David Weinberger's speech at Blog On. And Frank was essentially saying, you know, David had a great speech talking about PR and blogging. They don't get it. Big businesses don't get it. And that's what has me worried about what we're in right now, whether you want to call it a bubble or not. I'm not going to necessarily, you know, debate whether it is or not, but what has me concerned is that too much money is going to get thrown at this, and a lot of ideas that should not get funding are going to get funding, and we're going to be in another bubble, and then it's only going to eat itself in another year or so. It's only that's going to make it
even
worse.
No, that inevitably happens. Human nature creates bubbles. But what worries me more, Chris, is what you wrote about over the weekend, which is the attack of the splogs and how quickly that can screw everything up for everyone.
Well, my perspective, I mean, yes, I came out and lambasted Blogspot because they're the tallest nail, and quite honestly, they're the problem child right now. It's not the Blogspot service itself that I'm worried about. It's not necessarily, people will say, well, it's because you subscribe to an ego feed. I'm saying, don't look at the problem today. Look at where it's going to be when the popular keywords beyond ego searches are just flooded. I mean, just completely flooded. And if
it's 80% of blog traffic today is spam in one sense or another. And And even though SIPFRE came out and said, probably quite accurately, that only about 8% of the blogs are spam, the amount of traffic hitting the ping servers is just, it's overwhelming. And that's part of the reason, I think, why Dave Weiner had to sell or decided to sell his service to a big company, to VeriSign, because, you know, the amount of scaling involved and dealing with all that, and a lot of that was spam, just became, you know, overwhelming. He could no longer sort of do it as a hobby anymore.
Who do you think is going to develop an authentication system that is going to be or at least curb the effect of spam or make it unspammable? Which
I think what VeriSign has in the works is pretty exciting. And I am a little bit privy to what they're thinking because I represented Dave in the transaction when he sold to VeriSign. So I've seen a little bit about what their plans are. I obviously can't talk about it beyond what they've written on their blogs and what they've in press releases, but I think they're pretty serious about fixing a lot of the problems that we're seeing today. Hopefully those good intentions actually result in good products. And if they do, then I think we'll have some good stuff.
It just seems that as soon as someone dangles some type of financial carrot in front of somebody else, that's when spammers attack. And I don't know if financial levy is going to stop it. I don't know if legal action is going to stop it. I mean, of anybody, you'd probably be more qualified to speculate as to what is it going to take to just rule these people out of existence.
There's two ways to address it. I mean, if you're talking about spam blogs, you stop them before they get to the ping servers, or stop them after?
Well, no, not just blogs. I'm talking in the general sense of abusing this commons. I mean, if you abuse society, you get thrown in jail. And that system isn't perfect, certainly. But it also acts, there's enough, I know enough that if I were to walk outside and drop kick my dog down the street, I'm probably going to get hauled off to jail. And I know that, and that's what keeps me from doing it when he doesn't listen to me. Of course, I'm just using that as an example, not to say that I would ever drop kick Wicket down, although there are times. So,
I've seen you murder spiders on before.
Well, so. Yeah, that's right. I am an arachnophobe, no doubt. But I know in my mind, I mean, there are people that certainly break the law, and they do so willingly. You know, they're get passionate about something, something happens, and then boom. But there doesn't seem to be that space within the internet. There doesn't seem to be police, so to speak, or any type of actions that accountability for one's actions or in causing damage. Yeah, you know, certainly viruses get chased, virus writers get chased down and thrown in jail. But there's the problem is so out of control, and nobody has a solution. And every solution that they try just hasn't worked.
I mean, my opinion is law enforcement focuses generally on violent crimes because elected officials need to focus on violent crimes to get reelected. They also focus on things like piracy because there's very deep pockets that fund lobbying efforts to make that focus on piracy. I'm not sure there's any deep pockets at this point that are really focused on having law enforcement get involved in fixing spam problems. So I wouldn't look to them. I'd look to the Googles of tomorrow that will come up with their versions of PageRank and other tools that will at least, give us weapons to fight back. And I think it'll be a permanent and ongoing battle.
Do you think Google has done everything in their power to curb the spam problem? Or do you think they were just in a position where they said, oh, it's good enough for now, until this weekend's eruption happened?
Have they done anything?
Have they done enough? Or had they done enough?
I don't know if they've done much of anything. I mean, it's odd that the company that makes the most money on Splogs is also the company that hosts, almost all of them. So it's awfully easy to point fingers at Google and say that, that they are turning a blind eye to this problem because it positively affects their bottom line. So I don't necessarily think Google is being anything other than evil in this instance. So.
I was very hesitant to draw the same conclusion in one of my entries, saying that I was not willing to follow the money trail, and I did not want to believe that to be true.
But you have to follow. I mean, if you read Battelle's book on search, which I actually just finished last night, he talks about at least a couple of examples in Google's history of them making product changes that arguably made the search better, but also enhanced the bottom line. Making algorithm changes that pulled out e-commerce companies from the search results. at the same time that they launched AdWords. You know, it certainly is suspicious. So, you know, it's hard to say whether they did it, you know, purposely or not.
On the same token, if I'm searching for, let's say, a Marriott hotel in Seattle, the first result I would want to see would be from Marriott, not necessarily from XYZ affiliate in New Jersey.
No, you want to see Marriott.com or whatever their website is.
The localized version of it. So, and I think I see Google kind of creeping that way. And, you know, recently they've really done a lot more to institute a lot of the personalized aspects of it, which is just kind of... In one way, it's really cool, but in another way, it's not cool at all. You know, I've seen certain search results that I'm getting with this URL that I send on to somebody else, and they're not getting the same search results. Like, at least with Google, like with that URL. And that like, I'll say, hey, look at the number 5 hit for X, and I'll send them the link. They're like, what? It's like, It's because now with when I've associated my Gmail account with my Google service and then I'm tracking searches, it's actually changing the results based on my patterns in searches and behaviors and I mean, kind of building a profile. So pretty soon, you know, if I search for Will and Grace, well, we all know the TiVo story.
Yep.
Now with TechCrunch, whether you knew it or not, you've positioned yourself as pretty much the place to find quote unquote Web 2.0 news. Do you see yourself as just kind of sticking inside that realm, or doing other things with that particular blog?
I am only hesitating because, as you mentioned the Marriott example, I did a search on Google and Gotta Be, and I would say the results on Gotta Be for Marriott were significantly more relevant than what I saw on Google. So,
really?
Marriott did not appear in the native search results on the first page of Google, and I found it very quickly on Gotta Be. So,
well, wait till we go local with Gotta Be, then it'll really be relevant.
There, so. With regard to TechCrunch and where it's going, I think its extreme focus is actually an asset, and widening the net will only make me sort of average at other things instead of talking about more things than what I focus on, which is companies and new products, once a week I do a wrap-up with news that I find interesting, I've actually created something called a Web 2.0 workgroup, which at this point, it's web2.0workgroup.com, and at this point it's just a destination site where we put up sites that we think are addressing the Web 2.0 space from lots of different angles and we think are interesting reads. So Richard McManus at the Read Write Web, who does nothing but think about Web 2.0 and talk about things from that standpoint, is up there. We have designers, Dave Weiner's up there, and we have some pod tech guys as well. To me, that's a lot more interesting. It's letting people specialize and then just making sure that we group together in a way that we can spread our content around.
And intercommunication, well, if that's a word. Can I use that as a word? Intercommunication?
Sure.
I don't know. Well, no, it's. I didn't realize that that was your effort. That particular conglomeration. Are you outputting that in OPML, a reader list yet? Okay, I wasn't sure.
Of course we are.
Sure.
And as soon as Dave gets the reading list stuff together, we're gonna output it in dynamic OPML.
You know what? Speaking of OPML, another application that the programmer, the guy who's developing it, I think is doing more interesting things beyond just the application itself. Taskable. Have you looked at this?
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit. I know it's a mini browser that you can do stuff in OPML and RSS, but I have not downloaded it and used it yet.
I sent him an update to the icon because the old one just sucked. I'm like, dude, the days of 16 color icons are so Windows, 3.1, So I sent him an update. I'm like, here, it's alpha blended. It's got this, this, and this. And even maybe he wanted it with the guy with the mouth open. I was like, okay, fine. Here's the surprise look guy. Don't ask me why you want it this way, but okay. I can whip out icons like none other. Like, you tell me, I'm like, sure, I can do this, I can do this, I can make it fade like this, and like, no big deal. That's easy for me. I can get that done in like 5 seconds or less. Or your next one's free.
So do you like Taskable?
In seeing what it is and its potential, yeah, I think it's cool. Would I run it? Maybe. What I think is interesting is what he has enabled me to do. And it's kind of given me a different way of looking at what I'm doing with Gotta Be. So right now, if you go to Gotta Be's front page, what we've got is a Lycos top 50 that we're basically taking from Lycos with credit. We're saying, hey, you know, this is Lycos top 50. And I started thinking, well, you know, Yahoo outputs all these buzzes, so why don't we rotate whoever sends us a feed of something, an OPML file that we're able to parse and then push into Gotta Be, and then remix right on the front page in a random fashion. So we can take any of the Yahoo indexes. We can take, if MSN has an index, if Google has an index that they're outputting the top search terms from, there's an easy way to get it and collect it, we can throw it on the front page to give people an idea about what other people are searching for elsewhere, and then let them search for those terms at Gotta Be to kind of expand that search, expand that bubble. So the Taskable guy, I think it's at taskable.com too. We had been going back and forth with this. So he showed me basically how he input the top 50 Lycos terms and output them as Gotta Be OPML files. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. Well, if I can take this and do this and then do this and then expose that, I thought what he was doing on the back end was more interesting than what he was doing on the front end. So,
well, like I said, I'm not educated enough on the product to talk about it, but I've been told by Dave Weiner that it's interesting and I should look at it, and I've also the founders also emailed me, so I intend to do something with it in the next few days.
Well, ask, because TechCrunch is in there. Ask Dave who gave him the idea for a start menu aggregator years ago. I said this is what I'd love to have is my news aggregator is a start menu. It cascades out in the internet, shortcuts. And
so
everything.
You're taking credit for that, is what you're
saying? Oh, I know, I am taking credit for that. Dave did it. Dave can take credit for programming, but I said, Dave, this is what I want. He got mad at me though.
What is Dave's last name?
Weiner.
Oh, Dave Weiner.
Yes, Dave. No. Dave Weiner. Dave Weiner.
Taskable.
No.
Yeah, I've heard of Dave Weiner.
Yeah, of course.
But who created Taskable?
Oh, God, his name eludes me. I'm having problems with names today. I'm much more of a face guy. Names I can kind of get, like, in associations, like, or either this, or someone will mention a name, and then they'll say their website, and I'll go, oh, yeah, you know, oh, that's you.
Yeah, and that's true with bloggers, is that you know them by their blog name, and not their real name.
That's
so
true. Well, it's funny, Jakob Nielsen, who I disagree with on a very frequent basis, it recently had said his top 10 design tips, and the last one was basically don't be on a hosted service, and it just kind of fit very well within the whole blog explosion that happened this weekend. Yeah. All the Blogspot users kind of got mad at me. All the legitimate ones, they said, "Well, we don't want to kill the service." I was like, "You got to understand, you're playing in a world where the more I associate that brand with crap, doesn't matter who else is in there." It's in my mind, and my mind share now is limited to thinking a Blogspot in a certain way, as easily explainable.
When I see it, I think second class blog. I think, oh, this is somebody who either there's some nepotism reason why they're using it. They used to work there, or whatever, or they just don't know any better. And it's too bad because there is some good content there.
Oh no, certainly. I mean, there are quite a few people who I respect very deeply that I subscribe to on the Blogspot server. Several, countless. But when I go through and surf through and looking for, well, I've done it now a couple times just to kind of see how many I could pick up, spam or splogs, I'm noticing, you know, a lot of legitimate users, but a lot of them seem to be kind of MSN Spaces users. The blogs are good for maybe a couple of people, or for people who said who've got a service online and were told that they should do it in a blog. That's the Blogspot is where they go to. Much like if you're a suicidal teenage girl, it's LiveJournal. I mean, there's no argument. That's the space. That's where you go. If that's you, that's the ultimate place for you is LiveJournal. And it's what it's going to be for the rest of LiveJournal's life, no matter what Six Apart does with it. It's interesting, though, to you get a different feel for a blog depending on either where it's hosted, what it looks like, what it feels like. It's very, very interesting indeed. And I don't think a lot of people who are on Blogspot, who've been there for a while and have established themselves as names, I don't think they've necessarily thought of that. Or now it's gotten so far along that when Scoble changed his URL, I don't know if they got the proper redirect on that. But man, that is deadly. That is not advised at all.
Yep, you lose your links.
You lose links, you lose subscribers, you lose a lot. And I understand why, you know, Robert moved, and I think the move was you know, very good for him. But at the same time, you start with an idea. If you're going to go with a hosted service, at least make sure you can get your own URL and you can keep your own URL. That's good advice. It's
so easy, even though some people are, it's a little daunting at first, but it's so easy to get your own URL. You can get them for $6 or $7. Yahoo, GoDaddy, there's a million registrars. And all you have to do is point it wherever you are, and then it's yours. And you can move that anywhere you want. So
that's where I went to for .be is GoDaddy.
Yeah?
Did
you see the Super Bowl ad last year?
No. I don't watch the Super Bowl, not even for commercials.
I watched the ad. Yeah.
Now, I remember hearing about it, but it just wasn't, I don't know. It wasn't there yet. Now that the internet's kind of moved to where it is, you know, I'll be watching the BitTorrent networks for the, you know, the best of, or, you know, people updating, you know, and sending that stuff out. And hopefully, maybe by the next Super Bowl, it'll be a hell of a lot easier to do, although I'm not holding my breath. Honestly, Dave Weiner, if you watched, and no doubt you did, you watched Nerd TV, his interview, right?
I did.
And you dropped a load at the very end, didn't you?
I did. especially when he mentioned me.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. But I dropped a load in the beginning when he said he was a drug dealer in his early days.
Oh, no. Come on. You didn't know?
I didn't know.
It's funny. Well, yeah, it's... I think it was interesting that
That is a great. That is actually a great historical document. I'm glad that was done, and it was a good interview, and it really let Dave just talk and be himself. So
I sent him a message after watching it, and I said, you know, hey Dave, I just watched you on Nerd TV. I really enjoyed it. I feel smarter for watching it, but I don't know why yet. And he laughed. He thought it was funny that I said that. But I felt that way. I was like, I watched it, and you know, I know Dave, and we've certainly come to blows at points in the past and disagreeing on things, but. There was something about that interview that just felt, like you said, it felt historical. It felt that there was something there, and I'm not exactly sure. I couldn't put my finger on it, but it was very neat to see that, to watch that. I can't remember where I was going with that.
88 megabyte download, but worth.
Yeah, no, it certainly was. It certainly was. And there's no doubt in my mind. One of the good examples of good content on the web, since a lot of it just seems to be crap. I mean, by and large, I say what you want about video blogs. I just do not see a huge value in 95% of them. I think they'll appeal to smaller groups of people, but watching a video blog to me is like sitting through someone else's home movies sometimes, and listening to a podcast in many times in many ways is like listening to someone else's voicemail, and it's great if that is for you and you're getting something out of it. But I was in the car the other day with Robert Scoble, and someone else is in the car too, Andrew Edwards from Gear Live, and we were listening to Podshow on what was it, XM or Sirius? I can't remember which one.
Sirius, I think.
Yeah, maybe that was it. And we were listening to it, and it was just kind of like, what's the point? I don't get it.
It doesn't know what. Well, I don't want to get into that, but it doesn't know what it is. It doesn't,
right.
Which
is its coolness. And when I was explaining this to a lot of suits last night, I said it's great because my mom, and I'm not being sexist at all, she loves to crochet. She would love to be able to flip on the radio or flip on the computer and automatically just listen to the latest crochet news. Only like, you know, a handful of people in the world care about that. I mean, probably, you know, thousands if not millions of people. But it's still, it's not, that's where I think, you know, podcasting gets interesting. It's not in the sense that anybody can do it, because certainly anybody can take digital photos. But if you've ever, you know, browsed Flickr, you know, only a small portion of them are actually, you know, very beautiful photos because they were taken by photographers. Just like a lot of the content out there, the better stuff is the stuff that's better produced. Whether it takes a lot of money or not, it's just because you can do it doesn't mean you should. And even with the blogosphere, like I would argue that probably about, you know, 70-80% of the blogs out there now, you know, like on Yahoo 360 or MSN or even Blogspot, the hosted blog services, they're going to outweigh those, like the tech crunches, because it's only going to be interesting for maybe five other people or the people in their circles.
Yeah.
And for podcasting, that's neat, but I think it's kind of unfortunately gone the other route. There's a lot of it that just doesn't. There's so much of it that. And it's so overwhelming, and it's so disorganized that it's still impossible to find what it is you want to hear. It's still impossible. And the problem is you have to wade through a lot more crap. then
you tried out? Have you looked at Yahoo's new podcasting product yet?
I've seen it, but I haven't. Here's the thing: I can record this stuff all day long, but that's what I'm doing. I'm producing. I'm not necessarily consuming all the time. When I'm consuming, I'm in the car, and right now, I don't have like a gadget gizmo or whatever. I don't hook up a portable player because it's still a pain in the ass, and I don't use I don't use an iPod. I don't want to use an iPod. I think ultimately, Dave. This is what I was going to come to with Dave on Nerd TV. He said something that I think was very telling, saying that Apple, it better enjoy its time with the iPod because ultimately it's not going to work. It's a closed system. It's a very, very, very closed system. And people have been saying this for a while. I haven't drank the Kool-Aid. I do not own an iPod. I think it's overpriced. I don't like the way they sell music. I really don't like the way they sell shows. $2 an episode? Excuse me? And I understand I have the rights to watch it in the places where you say I can watch it. It's still not good enough for me. You know, give me something that's low access. Let me put it this way. I'm paying over $80 a month for Comcast service for every possible channel that I would want to see, all the movies I want to see, all the television shows I want to see,
and you
everything.
Don't watch any of it.
Yeah, and either I don't have time or it's not coming to me in the way I want it to. It's not working right.
I don't disagree with any of this, but I'm the opposite. Like when I was actually on Memorandum one day, and you know all the stuff came up that the VideoPod is out, and I grabbed my engineer and we ran down to the Apple Store without even thinking to buy one immediately, and it would have been my third iPod. And of course they didn't have it, and I don't know if they have them now. I still don't have one, but I just think they're so beautifully designed and so just great that I want one. It's just a piece of art just to hold on to. I disagree on that. But I will say this: closed systems suck, and they're a closed system, and that's going to have to either change or their time will pass. So.
If this is one thing that would move you to the iPod, one thing. Well, actually, maybe a couple things. One, I would like to have inherent WMA support because I'm a Windows user.
Yeah.
I don't want any of this transferring to AAC or
it
MP3.
It would be much nicer. Yeah.
So I would want that, and I would also want a Napster type of service. That I would buy into.
You mean the subscription fee for everything?
Yeah. I am not a freeloader by any stretch of the imagination. We pay a Netflix service fee, we pay a Comcast service fee, we still buy music, we've got Napster, we consume. So I feel absolutely, and I had written about this, I feel no guilt in making my own convergence happen, in downloading the latest episode of something in HDTV, because here's why. I've got a Comcast DVR tuner that sucks. It does not record what I say I want it to record. I want it to record the HD version. It doesn't. I want it to just record this. It doesn't. So I have access to the HD TV version of X show, whatever it happens to be. What's the difference between me watching it there or downloading it after the fact in a prepackaged format, ready to consume it the way I want to consume it? Other than, this is the bit, this is where they always catch it. Well, but someone's edited out the commercials. I said, well, wait a minute. They should be happy I'm, number one, watching the show in the first place. Number two, tell me one person, name me one person on the planet that has the ability to fast forward through commercials and doesn't.
I have a different perspective, but an additional perspective on this. My roommate in law school is one of the executive producers of the show CSI, very popular show. And by the way, if you go back through the various episodes of CSI, there have been three or four characters, always the people who are dead, who are named Michael Arrington, which is my name, which I find kind of funny. But,
your claim to fame.
I had dinner with him at one point early this year, and I actually was trying to understand the economics of these TV shows. And what we estimated is that based on, 25 million people watch the show every week, number of ads they have, the average price per ad, it came out to something like they get 30 to 40 cents in revenue per show, per viewer. And it's not a direct relationship because the ads are shown, but, it's what it works out to. So, am I willing to watch a half-hour or hour-long show and pay 30 or 40 cents to get rid of the commercials? Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
And I'll tell you that your all-you-can-eat service, where you pay $5 or $10 a month or whatever it is, based on how much I actually watch, that's going to increase revenue for the TV shows from me as a user dramatically over what I do now because I just don't watch the shows. So I think it's a brilliant idea.
Well, some people have pontificated on this recently, too, including Terry Heaton, is one of the people I respect the most, who is still very much active in the television sphere. You know, affiliates are going to lose a lot of revenue real soon. And the internet's really, and the video iPod yeah. type of services is what's going to basically eliminate the need for an affiliate. And the writing is certainly
absolutely
on the wall. And it's, convergence is going to happen. It's just not going to happen from the top down. It's going to happen from the bottom up.
Absolutely.
And it's happening. I basically said convergence is happening now. It's just very, very messy. It's very messy. And
what percentage of desktop PCs are media centers today? Is it over 50% or something?
Yeah, that's what Microsoft says. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I just do not believe that. I don't think the media center PC is usable at this point. It's cool and it's nice, but it ain't anywhere near the usability of like a TiVo. And it tries to succeed. The problem with Microsoft is they rest too much on building a platform and not a good user experience. So they basically give you an erector set of sorts. They kind of give you the basic shell of something, but they say, here, you put on everything else. And then we're beholden to developers. And unfortunately, much like, you know, Dave Weinert said in his Nerd TV interview, you know, some developers see themselves as gods, and they feel that they should be treated as gods and kneel at my feet. I am a software developer. And it's just true. I don't want to rely on a developer to develop something for me that the person who actually created the product should have created for me. I'm not interested in the power of the platform. I'm interested in what you're doing with a platform that you developed. Or I'm interested in possibly easily being able to change the way that works. And that's where I think a lot of people get frustrated with software. And the more proprietary the piece of software is, the less likely it is to actually increase in value. For me, at least. For me.
Sure.
It's just bits.
Sure, but it is. But even if it's a smaller percentage, and even if it does suck, and I have a media center, and I agree there's huge room for improvement, it is changing the way everyday people watch TV on a massive scale. And, you know, the writing is on the wall for these guys.
You know, honestly, BitTorrent, just a few more tweaks, man, and I'm telling you, that's going to replace a lot of media center. A lot of what media center is and does. That someone could easily not subscribe to anything and get everything that they wanted easily.
I just wish BitTorrent, and by the very nature of BitTorrent, you know, it's the popular stuff is what is easiest to get, and the long tail stuff is so much harder. I just wish that, you know, there was enough critical mass where, you know, even, you know, 3-year-old episodes of CSI were easy to grab.
Well,
and I don't know how far we are from that.
If and when the networks finally get it, we're forcing them to. Yeah, we as in users, you know, the people who are just kind of pushing the envelope, are forcing them to. It still may take a while. I think they're happier with a model like what iPod puts forth with like $2 an episode. Man, I know $2 isn't a lot of money. It's a cup of coffee, but the value of a TV show to me is not that high. It's not that high. Would I buy into a season of something that I like? Yeah, sure. Yeah, I'd buy that. Or would I buy a subscription package, and as you said, an all-you-can-eat plan? Yeah, I'd be the same way. I'd buy an all-you-can-eat plan right now. Unfortunately, you know, I don't have time for it, or the processes through which I'm trying to get content, it doesn't work. So I'm left to my own, literally, left to my own devices, literally and figuratively, to try to make my lifestyle work for me on my terms. And DRM, honestly, is only for marketers. And as soon as they understand that, I think people are they won't mind DRM at all. DRM is for marketers. And if DRM is for marketers, then the content that they're slapping DRM should be free.
Yeah, I agree, and I hope that's the way it plays out, where, you know, just DRM gets kicked out of the ecosystem because it just isn't sustainable. So
it's going to happen, whether people want it to or not, and businesses will adapt. They'll be forced to adapt. And the funny thing is I know a handful of people. I'll refer back to the speech I gave, or the panel I was on last night. A handful of the people in the room actually had businesses where I was basically saying you're screwed. This is my opinion, of course. Just my opinion. You know, basically saying DRMs, we'll figure a way around it, no doubt about it. But I asked them. Or in a very I wasn't expecting an answer. It was a rhetorical question, like thinking. I said, "Nothing. Just think about your own habits. I bet you anything. How many of you have something on your hard drive that you know you shouldn't have on your hard drive? And I'm not talking about pictures. I'm talking about, like, some type of media file.
Music, for the most part.
Music,
yeah.
You know,
movies.
Video. How many of you have fast-forwarded through TV commercials? I mean, so, you know, on one hand, your day job may be, we're creating the world's best uncrackable DRM, but in reality, you're acting completely different. And that kind of disparity is what's causing a lot of frustration and is what is kind of catalyzing and pushing from the ground up. And Doc Searles has got an excellent speech on this about talking about how technology starts at the bottom and not from the top necessarily. And not always the case. But in terms of the groundswell movement behind, I think, what's happening, what you're covering with TechCrunch, it's certainly, its roots are founded in the idea of we're frustrated with everything else that's out there. And so we have to create something that we're not going to be frustrated with.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. DRM is I mean, we have to find a way to respect copyright in some form or another. But DRM is just man-made friction, and it's funny because most of the companies that I profile and like are removing friction from the system. And it's not man-made friction, it's just the friction that exists from previous business models. And yet we have, you know, this entire legal framework that's trying to add this additional layer of friction to what people can do with content, and it's going to break at some point. I don't know what the future is going to look like, but it sure isn't going to look like, you know, where we are today.
Well, I think we just have to figure out making it easier for them to monetize content. And they're doing it now. I mean, hell, you can buy old episodes on DVDs. You know, you could, you know, pay-per-view. I mean, well, for instance, I was talking to Jake, who's the engineer and producer for the Chris Perillo show, and we were talking about movies and whatnot, and he had mentioned that it costs him over $30 to go out to the movies right now with his wife and his kid. And I'm thinking, dude, you could buy a DVD for like about half that cost. Well, you know, probably about $20 or so when it comes out, you know, if it was just, you know, brand new.
Or just get it on Netflix.
Yeah, or get it somehow and pay a lot less money for, you know, virtually the same experience. I mean, of course, there's nothing that's ever going to match the theater experience, but the theaters are not going the right route in the sense that they're charging more money. That actually drives us away, not necessarily to. And home theaters are coming down in price. HDTV, it's coming down. It's coming down.
And the time to DVD release is coming down dramatically as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, certainly. So. It's only going to be quicker. If anybody's in trouble, it's going to be them. I don't think radio's in trouble anytime soon. I think movie theaters, certainly, I think, have got to start reinventing. And movie theaters, almost, for them to succeed, they have to become commons. They have to become almost like a Starbucks has become. And even Starbucks,
yeah.
Starbucks is more of a Sam Goody than Sam Goody. I mean, you walk into a Starbucks recently.
It's the only place I buy CDs,
yeah,
other than online anymore, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, it's funny.
Is Sam Goody still in existence?
I think they are, virtually. I think they've changed their name to FYE. If not, they were bought out by somebody else. But the idea of the idea of going into a coffee house and this is like your leisure, this is your mindset, you're kind of in the mood, your culture, you feel like this is a cultural place. Ultimately, I think movie theaters have to adapt to that kind of lifestyle in order for them to succeed, in order for them to kind of get past where they are today. And I think, you know, once that big change, Lowe's is a big one. There are only a couple of them now, I guess, but that, I think, the physicality, because of it's so cost prohibitive at this point.
I think it's an interesting vision. What about music? How does music, you know, from the band level to the label,
you know,
when they make money over time?
You're going to listen to music no matter what. Part of it is merchandising, you know, quite honestly. You know,
what about concerts?
Branding, Bobby. Merchandising, concerts.
Yeah.
It's offering more access. You know, when my favorite bands roll through town, yeah, I go and watch them. You know,
and does that mean the music will be free eventually? Is it has to be because it's too easy to copy?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think there is still always going to be a market for a CD, a physical product. Maybe not forever, but at least for the time being, certainly. It's being able to make sure that in whatever form it is, if I have it on CD, I have it anywhere. If I have it on my iPod, I have it anywhere. And that kind of idea, it's getting access, paying for the content once. That's it. So it's like if I buy something on Amazon, I only pay for it once, and then it's mine. It's knowing that I don't have to worry about being frustrated when I need or want to move to a different device, and having that kind of open playability. And we're just not there yet. We're still locked up in proprietary and branding and walled garden type of services and scenarios. So I wouldn't want to say that the music's going to be free. I certainly think, you know, there's still a value that's ascribed to it. The music industry certainly is going to have to change. I mean, they're literally grasping at straws. Is that what I'm thinking? No, they're. Mm-hmm. Is that the metaphor that I'm looking for?
Yeah, but I also think that they've seen what's happened in the music industry. You said the movie industry is right, and I think they've seen what's happened in the music industry, and they're.
But they're not taking. Yeah, they're not taking any steps to change it. They're taking steps to fight it, and it's like trying to stick your thumb in a hole in the dike. You know, the flood's coming. You know, you're not. You're not going to change anything by throwing a 16-year-old in jail. Let me put it this way: if I downloaded a Mannheim Steamroller album off of BitTorrent, I wouldn't feel guilty at all because I have the I bought the CD. It's just making someone else has ripped it for me. That's it.
Yep.
I'm not stealing at all. I am not stealing. And quite honestly, to tell you the truth, if it was a label that had screwed me over with so many poorly produced CDs in the past, is it really stealing?
I'm on the same page.
Who screwed who first?
Yeah, and how many times do I have to buy the same album?
Yeah! How many times do you expect me? So the money is going to change hands, and ultimately, the person who creates the content, you know, deserves to get the money. But the person who is the funnel for this, you know, deserves to get a piece of the pie as well. It's what happens after that point that I think is still up in question. We still consume in public. We still get goods and services elsewhere. There are times where, you know, like Ponzi bought the Beck album, the actual album, the recent one, which is actually really, really good. But I said, Ponzi, we have that on Napster. What are you doing? He said, yeah, but I couldn't rip from Napster and blah, 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 blah. I'm like, well, yeah, but you can put it on your device. It's just a pain in the ass. So I've now had, in my opinion, even though I'm renting that at this point, I feel like I've bought it twice, and that really pisses me off.
You did buy it twice.
It makes me mad. And then if I want to listen to it on something else, and if I can't get to it if it's proprietary, then I've got to pay for it again. It's absolutely maddening. Absolutely maddening.
Well, so here's a question. The RIAA has gone after all these people, and they continue to sue. And as far as I know, no one has actually fought them. I mean, actually hired a lawyer and spent the hundreds of thousands they probably would need to fight them. Would you do that if you were sued, or would you settle?
Would I go after them?
Would you fight them?
The RIAA?
Or would you settle for the $5,000 or whatever that they end up wanting?
Oh, no, I'd fight them. Tooth and nail.
Yeah, I think I would, too.
Tooth and nail, I'd fight them. Because there's not a single person...
Anyway, would be worth it.
You know what? There's not a single person on the planet who, other than the people who are losing money, i.e. the people who have screwed us over for years, who would be upset. I have no problem... Like I said, you can look at my bills. I pay money to access content on a regular basis.
Yeah.
I am not.
Yeah.
So to sit there and call me, you know, to say shame on you, what do you mean shame on you? I'm asking you to give it to me the way I want it. Do you not understand the business model that I'm handing over to you? Do you understand that I'm saying, look, I want to pay for the stuff that you're offering. Just make it so that I can afford to do it. That I want to do it. That's an enjoyable experience.
Subscribe to Napster, which proves that you're willing to pay for this, and that you really like that business model.
And then I'm paying HBO I download HBO content on BitTorrent all the time, but I'm paying for it.
Yep.
I'm paying for it. I'm just watching it on my own terms, but I'm paying for it. And HBO doesn't have commercials, but I'm paying for it. So, you know, if HBO wants to track how they get seed through BitTorrent and say you can get, you know, through the HBO tracker or whatever like that, and to basically access that tracker with this, you have to have an HBO account, you know, and then once you've unlocked that HBO account with whatever the unified whatever, I don't care. If it's an honor system, which they say is not very it's not very profitable, or if it's giving me access to something else, you know, there's certainly other ways to charge me for this stuff. Certainly, you know, or you look at certain things as loss leaders for other products. That's been done before too. There are plenty of business models to be had and seen in every aspect of this. But that's, it's again my opinion. That's my opinion. And I'm sure.
Well, certainly, it'd be interesting to see how this plays out.
Well, if the RIA comes after me, let me tell you, I don't think I'm going to have a problem finding someone who would help me fight them.
No, I will contribute to your legal defense fund if that happens. I will say that right now.
And I'm not sitting here, hey, look, you know, sitting duck here, I'm not a major file share pirate, you know, kind of guy. But at the same time, it's inevitable. It's a flood. And they're only making matters worse. They're not. They could be making them so much better if they would just listen instead of thinking that control was still possible. The world has changed, and the world will continue to change, and they will continue to feel pain. Anything that they could do to any one individual is a drop in the bucket compared to what's going to happen to them. So they can either spend their time and spend their resources on doing something that is actually going to add to their bottom line instead of just watching it just drain out of their pockets. Because that's what's happening right now. It's just draining. And they screwed us over every step of the way. So,
well,
I don't
historically,
know.
Industries need to be disrupted and ripped apart before they're able to sort of, you know, regenerate. And I think that's going to have to happen with all these content industries, movies and music, et cetera. So they're not going to lose their business model without fighting.
I got to put something else on this. Do you watch The Family Guy at all?
Of course.
Okay, huge Family Guy fan here. I bought the CD or the DVDs. I bought all the DVDs. So in a way, I brought Family Guy back on television. I was one, maybe a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of a percent, but I still helped bring Family Guy back to television.
Yes, you did.
I paid for the DVDs. I paid for the content. I paid for the physical content, the physical bits. If it was physical bits or virtual bits, I would love it if it was virtual because then I wouldn't have to track anything and I can get it no matter where I was or anything. That'd be a great way to go. But paying for accessing that stuff and then being able to take it wherever I can, and, well, in so many ways. So it's
Well, thank you for helping to bring it back to TV. That was great.
You bought the DVDs too. You would have had to have.
I did not buy the DVD. But now that you've made me feel guilty, I will go out and buy it.
No, it's not to feel guilty, but it just shows. I think that some people are kind of listening to the change that's happening. I don't think you would have seen Family Guy ever get resurrected had they really not paid attention to the numbers that the DVD sales brought in. I think it's very important that, you know, if it's something that we really like that we support, we need to support it, and that's the bottom. Ultimately, the bottom line. I'm not going to support crap. I'm not going to watch something that I don't want to watch. That's in my opinion not worth watching. So I'm not going to give it the attention that it deserves. And of course, Steve Gilmore, you know, say this is a perfect, you know, application, or there's an application in there for the attention economy. But if I like something enough, I'm going to support it in ways that they want me to support it. How they ask me to support it, I will. If I care for it enough. If I really, really like it. And if I really, really enjoy it and I really, really appreciate it. I'm certainly willing to do that. I've done it in the past. Some people aren't necessarily, you know, that same way. There are certainly a lot of people who take the opposite side to this equation.
They'll take advantage.
Yeah, they'll take advantage.
Especially when you're very anonymous, which you generally are online, altruism doesn't always flow through. And they talk about the donation economy. It doesn't work very well.
Nope.
People that put up software and ask for donations tend not to do well. And so I don't know if that's a solution, but there's got to be a way for content producers to make money without using DRM. So.
Well, we're making money. We get sponsored. So, you know, sponsorship goes a long way. You know, throwing in bugs goes a long way. You find out about a television show because another television show puts a little bug in the corner saying "Stay tuned for X," or you can download X, or it's a commercial. That is a commercial. It's a very smart commercial because you know you see it. It's there. You can't fast forward through that because you're fast forwarding through the content. So I live with it now. We live with it. I mean, on just about any given, you know, website, you live with it in the form of advertising. Where we don't like living with it is when it becomes invasive. And commercials to us, and the reason why we fast forward through them is because they are invasive. And a lot of it, if I ever see another commercial for a feminine hygiene product, it'll be too soon.
Yeah.
I'm not a female. I don't consume that. I don't need to consume that. I don't want to see that. And television at this point is still a very spray and pray
mechanism.
But that just
means you're watching shows where the primary demographic are, you know, women in that age group.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay, I admit.
Which means you're sitting there with Ponzi or you just like that kind of show.
No, I've watched some shows on Lifetime before, but that doesn't necessarily make more, you know, everyone, I flip through Oprah, you know, like I flip through stuff. If the content's interesting, yeah, I'm going to watch it. But if you're going to market to me for Christ's sake. You know, make it about me, not about what you think I want. This is my biggest problem with a lot of portals that are out there. A lot, not all of them. Services like I hate when they call it like a My Yahoo or My MSN because it's not necessarily mine. It's your mine, your My MSN, yeah. Not my MSN. There's a huge, yeah. Huge difference. In how those two ideas are perceived, and I think we're moving towards. I mean, the whole if there is a movement of Web 2.0, if you can slap a term on it, I think part of that is really making it a my, and making it easier to facilitate a my rather than a your my. And if there is a difference between a 1.0 and a 2.0, I think it's that a your my versus a my
ultimate
my.
Personalization.
Yeah. Real, true personalization. And
yeah, I'll buy into that as long as you can have communication on there as well. The ability not just to consume, but to create.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Remix, share, get it from point A to point B. Someone has to fit the bill, ultimately. I mean, let me put it this way. We're not exactly we're working our way to profitability with Gotta Be. We're getting there, but it's certainly costing us money. It's costing us money right now. But I think in what we're going to do with it, I think the benefits far outweigh the costs. Far outweigh. But Michael, thanks for taking your time and spending it with me.
It is my pleasure, Chris.
So
it's actually been nice getting to know you a little bit better. I didn't have a chance at the GnomeDex conference to actually even shake your hand. You were so busy running around.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Well, next time.
No. Definitely, no. I didn't mean that in a bad way. You're just very busy making sure the conference is going smoothly. So, and it was a terrific experience. So,
thank you
for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh,
and let me know when Gotta Be releases the next features you told me about off the record. Can't wait to read.
Oh yeah, no, it'll hopefully be soon. We've got moved over to some new hardware, and we've got a couple more updates coming. But the one thing that we're definitely going to be focusing on is adding a few more features to what we currently have. But then really. Going whole hog with the user customization level of things, so it's coming.
I can't wait to write about it.
I bet you're chomping at the bit. So thanks again, Mike.
Thanks, Chris.
The Windows Media Stream for the live broadcast of The Chris Perillo Show is provided by Limelight Networks. Listen to the live Chris Perillo Show in Windows Media Player. Download the latest version of the player for Mac and Windows users at Microsoft.com/Windows Media.